land. They said it's a great. Okay, we'll start with some things from the Sedra and a little bit about Tisha B'Av also. Okay, Rashi, Eila Hadvorim, Dovar, Dibur is always something strong, as opposed to Amira is something soft. So Eila Hadvorim, these are harsh words that Moshe Rabbeinu spoke. He gave the Jewish people Musar, and Rashi says that he only hinted to it. He hinted to all the places that they sinned first, out of honor, to honor the Jewish people, not to be very specific and to go into detail about what the sins were. He just hinted to them, and because he wanted to give honor to Klal Yisrael. There's only one problem, and that is that after this, Moshe Rabbeinu goes into great detail into all these sins. So where's the honor of Klal Yisrael? If he only would have hinted, right, so I would understand what the honor is. So somebody once said to me that the idea is that first he wanted to show them that he honors them, that he only hinted it. And then once they trusted him, they saw that he really is care, then he gave it to them. Another pshat I saw was that once he hinted them, they all did tshuva me'ava. And then the sins turned into mitzvahs. Now I can mention them. There's nothing wrong anymore. Now they're all mitzvahs. Okay. What do I think is the real answer? I think the real answer is the following. That we spoke about it, I think, last week, or no, in Parshas Balak we spoke about it. I'm not going to go through the whole idea again. But it has to do with the Haftorah of this week's Haftorah, Shabbos Chazon. Yoda shor kolnehu v'chamor evus ba'alov. Animals, oxen know who their master is. Donkeys at least know who feeds them. Yisrael yoda. The Jewish people didn't know these basic things. They didn't know who their master was. They didn't know who feeds them. It's basic instinctive ideas to animals. Why? Amilo his bonon, because they didn't think. Human beings, even though we do have instincts, but basically, we are not affected unless we think. Human beings were given the power to think, and therefore what makes an impression on us is what we think about. And if we don't think, and we just follow our instincts, then what is obvious instinctively to animals passes us by. And therefore, therefore Moshe Rabbeinu said like this, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, and I think that if I tell you something and hint to you, you'll think. You'll think into it. And if you'll think into it, then my telling you the sins openly, in detail, will make an impression and there'll be some benefit. But if you don't think, and I just have to hit you with all these sins, there's no purpose. Then it's just going to insult you and embarrass you. There's no purpose to it. So therefore, he told them the sins first by hint, that they have to think. They have to catch what he's talking about and think into it. And we'll see there was what to think into. And then, once he got them thinking, once he got their minds in gear, then he said, now that you're thinking, now it's going to be beneficial. So let's go through the details and see what happened and how to see to it that doesn't happen again. That's the Kvodim Shal Yisrael. It wasn't just that he hid it out of their honor. But he honored them and respected them enough to say that, I know you're thinking people. That's a respect. So what was the hint? How did the hint work? If you look at it, what did he hint them? He told them the following. Bamidbar. He said, the sins that you did when you entered the desert and the first few times you didn't have food, you didn't have water, and you said, we're going to die in this desert. And you didn't trust me or the Rabbanu Shel Olam. And then Ba'arava, all the way at the end, what the sin that you did in Baal Pa'or, the end of the desert. Mol Suf is two sins. When you went into the Yam Suf, you doubted that God was going to save you, and you said, let's go back to Egypt. And when you came out of the Yam Suf also, you didn't want to leave. You wanted to continue getting the wealth or whatever, and you rebelled there also after the splitting of the Red Sea. Bein Paran uvein Topha v'lavan. The next hint was Paran, was the sin of the spies. And Topha v'lavan is when you complained about the man. And Chatzeros is the sin of the, Korach. And Dizahav was the sin of the golden calf. Now, what is the obvious, glaring question here? They're not in order. Not in any kind of chronological order. So what is the order here? So I think I have an answer to that. We spoke at some point in the year that the greatest condemnation, the greatest mussar you can give somebody, is to show them that they are a self-contradiction. Right? That, not that, you know, you go to somebody and you say, how come you don't spend time learning Torah? Right? You don't have any time that you go to a shiur or whatever, and the person give an excuse. I don't have time. I'm busy. I work hard. I'm busy in the home. I have children. I just don't have time. Okay, so you can give them mussar and say, but, you know, it's important, and even if you don't have time, you have to make time. That's not very effective mussar, because the person always has an excuse. You know what the most effective mussar is? To tell the person, okay, I accept that. You're a busy person, you don't have time. But, you know, according to my records, this is God speaking, you know, after 120 years, according to my records, on this and this date, you spent an hour on the telephone speaking to your friend, gossip. Where'd you get the time for that? You didn't have time to sit down and open a sefer, but you had time to speak Lashon Hara for an hour? Person says, God comes and says, why didn't you give tzedakah? He said, God, you know, I didn't have any money. I'm a poor person. I barely eked out a living. The Rabban Shalom could then go into a whole tirade about how important tzedakah is, or he can say the following. Okay, I accept that. You're a poor person. You don't have money. Right? You eked out a living. I accept that. But according to my records, on this day, you went to this restaurant. Here was the bill. This was the tip. For a poor person who eked out a living, where'd you get the money to spend on the restaurant? If you spent on that, you could have given some money for tzedakah. So pointing out to a person how they're a self-contradiction is the worst kind of mussar, most effective too. That's exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu said over here. He said, if you look at these sins and you take them in pairs, they are totally contradictory. For instance, you sinned when you went into the desert. Okay, so we can understand, you know, people going into a desert, it's a traumatic experience. So they got scared, they panicked. Okay, there's an excuse. But you also sinned when you came out of the desert. Barava, you went through the desert, you came out, you're already in easy, you know, easy country, and you still sin. So don't tell me that you sinned because you were panicking because of the desert, because when that panic went away, you also sinned. Those are contradictions. Next thing. Mol Suf, right, went into the splitting of the Red Sea. So you're going to tell me, well, you know, we didn't know. We had the sea in front of us, and we didn't think it was going to split, and we panicked. So we sinned. So God says, okay, I accept that, but how come then after the sea split and you saw all the miracles, you still sinned? So don't tell me it's because you were afraid what was going to be and you didn't know the sea was going to split, because after it split, you also sinned. Next thing. Bein Paran uvein Topha v'lavan. Paran was when they sent the spies. Now, why did they send the spies? Because they said, you know what, until now we've been living a life of miracles. And we could rely on God because God does for us miracles all the time. But now we're what's it called? Thank you. But now we're going to Eretz Yisrael, and we know that everything's going to happen naturally. So we're not so sure how we're going to deal with a natural world. So you sinned because you couldn't deal with the natural world, right? You were okay with miracles, but nature was a problem. Okay, so you were confused or whatever. But how about, why'd you complain about the man? We know what you complained about the man. We can't take this miraculous food. We want something natural. It's a total contradiction. Right? Here, you sin because you were happy with the miracles and were afraid about the nature. Here, you sin because you weren't happy with the miracles and wanted nature. And the last thing, the machlokas of Korach, opposite the sin of the golden calf. Korach, they came and they said, who needs Moshe Rabbeinu? We don't need leaders. Right? And why did they sin by the golden calf? Because they put too much stock in Moshe Rabbeinu. And if Moshe's not here, what's going to happen to us? We need the leader. We need somebody to take his place. We need a golden calf. So here you sin because you didn't give importance to Moshe Rabbeinu. Here you sin because you gave too much importance to Moshe Rabbeinu. So if you look at all these things and take them in groups, they're the worst condemnation. That's what they had to think about. These are the sources of all the sins that came later on. And the idea is that over here there's a contradiction too. So he gave you what to think about. Now we'll go into the details of each sin individually, and you can't anymore explain them in a way that will just easily give you excuses, because all these contradictory things take away those excuses. So now you're going to have to deal with them in a realistic way. You're not going to be able to just discount them very easily. So Moshe Rabbeinu first hinted to them, let them start to think, let them see the reality of what the underpinnings of all of this is. And then he went into detail. Once they're thinking, now we'll get some benefit of going over these sins. Otherwise, just embarrass you and hurt your feelings. And what's the benefit from it? But if you're going to think, it'll help. Okay. That is that. Okay, next. Let's speak about the second point. So what is, it says in the Haftorah, right, that an ox knows its master, and a donkey at least knows who feeds it, and the Jewish people didn't know, because they didn't think. Okay, so they didn't know. But we see from here that the source of all sins, okay, the source of all sins is not thinking. But once you don't think, you come to the foundation of all sins, which is not having Hakaras HaTov, not recognizing good and being appreciative. Not being, having gratitude. That's the simple translation of Hakaras HaTov, gratitude. It doesn't mean that. We'll see in one second. Why? Because in order really to have a relationship with God, we can't see God. What can we see? What he does. What we benefit from here. God is good. That's what God is. And God does good. That's how we recognize God. He's HaTov, the HaMetiv. And we basically recognize him from the good that we get from him. And no matter how much bad a person gets in this world, the good always outweighs the bad. Unless he's alive. Unless he has a chance to live, he has a chance to get Olam Haba, if you really know what life is all about. So a person, eats and he drinks and he has the ability to sleep and to function. Even the basics of life are important. So if a person recognizes the good that he gets in this world, he'll recognize God. Okay, however, a person who doesn't recognize good is not going to recognize God either. If he thinks that everything's coming to him. Right? I once saw a political election billboard in Ranana. They were having elections for the mayor. And it said, vote for so-and-so, magi alochem. Now, I don't know if that was put up by the opposition or by the guy. But that's the way people feel, you know, magiali, right? There's nothing to be have gratitude about. It's coming to me, right? I deserve it. And if you have that kind of feeling, you'll never recognize the Rabbanu Shalom. You'll never recognize another person either or feel gratitude to anything. If magialecha, right, people think that they came into this world with a guarantee connected to their big toe that says you are guaranteed 100% satisfaction in this world, or you have the right to complain. And most people exercise that right very often. The rabbis taught us that's not the way to look at the world, by instituting a yontif after Tisha B'Av. We're going to take a vacation now till the beginning of Elul, into Elul, because I'll be away for the beginning of Elul. We're not going to have a shir before Tu B'Av. Right, Tu B'Av is Lo Hayu Yomim Tovim LiYisrael KeChamishaser Ba'Av KiYom HaKippurim. Tu B'Av is tremendous yontif. Women went out, girls went out and danced and made shiduchim on that day. Tremendous yontif. What's big deal about Tu B'Av? What are we celebrating? So according to one opinion in the Gemara, what happened on that day is Harugei Beitar were buried. After the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, about 50-something years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, second Beis HaMikdash, Bar Kochva mustered together his last stand in Beitar. Right? And it looked for 2.5 years, they already were minting coins. They already thought they had independence from Rome. And Rabbi Akiva and others thought that Bar Kochva was going to be Mashiach. And everything was destroyed in Beitar. Bar Kochva was killed. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed in Beitar. And the Romans were so cruel that they didn't let their bodies be buried. They left their bodies to the elements for about 3 years. 3 years later, they were able to bury the bodies miraculously. They got to the bodies, they were able to bury them, and they found that the bodies didn't decompose. And on that day, they made a yontif, and they made a new bracha in benching, Hatov Ametiv, the fourth bracha in benching, Baruch Atah Hashem, Kel Avinu Malkeinu, Hatov Ametiv Lakol. That bracha was made in Yavne, in what's it called, to commemorate Haruge Beitar. Hatov, that they were able to be buried, and Ametiv, that they didn't decompose in all those years. So, what was the big yontif? You know, if I would have been there, I would have made a fast day. I mean, when you rebury somebody, it's a day you fast. It's a day of mourning. Okay, so these people were able to be buried. Okay, that's a very nice thing. But they didn't come back to life. They were still dead. Their bodies didn't decompose. I would have made a fast day and say you could eat 5 minutes early because they didn't decompose and they were able to be buried. So it's not, you know, total mourning. There's some good, there's a little silver lining in the cloud. Let's eat 5 minutes early. I would have made a yontif, making shiduchim, make a new bracha and benching. But what was the big deal? So I always like to say that the rabbis wanted to teach us a lesson. And that is, they saw that this was the final nail in the coffin of Golus. There's going to be a long Golus. And in Golus, there's not too many big, great, happy things that are going to happen. And if you don't recognize the small good, then you're not going to recognize any good. You'll never recognize the Rabbanu Shalom. If you have the attitude that I am magiali, 100% satisfaction, if I only get 99% I can complain, then you're going to have a miserable life. You can't have a marriage like that. If you expect 100% satisfaction from your spouse, right? Nobody can give anybody 100% satisfaction. Recorders on, except for my wife, of course. But otherwise, what's it called, doesn't happen in this world. So if you're looking for 100% satisfaction, you're going to have a miserable life. But if you have the opposite, nothing is what's it called coming to me. It's a bracha that I'm alive. If I live like Eov, it's worth being alive. If I have any good, I recognize that little good and I'm happy about it. Then you can have a happy marriage, you can have a happy life, you'll be happy with everything. Because every little bit of good you'll recognize and you'll have gratitude for it. That's the lesson that the rabbis wanted to teach us. In a different plane, it says that there were 2 days that had that same Yom Tov. L'hoyu yomim tovim l'Yisrael, like the 15th day of Av and Yom Kippur. I think the connection between them, a different, little bit different idea, but along the same lines, is that Yom Tov, what's Yom Tov mean? Say good Yom Tov. A good day. What does that mean? What's Yom Tov? So we explained way back, I think this year in Bereishis, that the word Tov doesn't necessarily mean good. It means something substantive. Something that can continue to exist. Vayar Elokim ki Tov. God saw that it has the ability to continue to exist. Hodu Lashem ki Tov ki liolam chasdo. It's something eternal. Olam habas yom shikulo Tov. Whatever has the more eternal its existence, the more good it is. That's Tov. Tov is Torah. Torah is eternal. Tov means something substantive and eternal. So, if that's the case, a Yom Tov is a day that transcends time. The day itself represents something that's beyond the temporal time of this world and represents something that's eternal. Those are the Yomim Tovim. Those are the days where the events of those days made them eternal days. They're not just days that pass by and that's it. There's some eternity in them. That's Yom Tovim. After the destruction of Beitar, it appeared that was the end of the Jewish people. That's it. Finished. They're finished. And the Rabban Shem showed it's not the case. And he did it by showing a miracle that the bodies didn't decompose and they were able to be buried. What is burial? Why do we bury bodies? Don't cremate them? Because we believe that there's a Tchias HaMeisim, that there'll come a time when these bodies will come back to life. The dead will come back to life. When you plant a seed, it deteriorates, it decomposes, and then it grows. When you plant a body, when you bury a body, it's like planting a seed. And eventually they'll sprout. So you show that you believe that you're putting the body into the ground. Yes, it's going to decompose, go back to its elements, but it's going to grow again. There's always seeds of growth in every destruction. Hold on. So therefore, the yontif of Chamish Asar Ba'av is the yontif that says that after physical destruction, the Jewish people are eternal. And there's a comeback. And they're not destroyed. That was the yontif of Tu Ba'av. And the same thing goes for Yom Kippur. People could feel that after they sin, spiritually, that's it. Finished. There's no recourse. Comes along Yom Kippur and says, there's hope. You could do tshuva. You could start again. Right? The sins themselves can be the incentive to do tshuva and to get even closer to the Rabban Shlom. And the sins can become like mitzvahs. So, they're both yomim tovim. They're days that represent eternity. Yom Kippur from spiritual destruction and Tu B'Av from physical destruction. And that's why all the other things that happen on Tu B'Av, the same thing. It's a day that when the decree of the death of those who were the ones who went out of Egypt stopped, and the new generation went on, right? There's an end, and there's a continuation. There's eternity, right? All the things, if you look in the Gemara, no time to go into it now, all the things represent that. It appeared to be an end, and yet there was a continuation. There's eternity. So that also is the yontif of Tu B'Av. It's a yontif of recognizing the small good in this world. Now the second thing of Hakaras HaTov, so once you recognize even small good, then you'll recognize all the good in the world. If you're only recognizing big good, there's nothing going to be big enough to recognize. Everything is Magiyali. So that's the first thing. Second thing is
that every end is the beginning of something.
Right.
That's the concept.
Right. And therefore, what's it called? Every little good also has seeds for the future. Nothing is too small to take into consideration. The ideas fit together. Okay, once you recognize the good, you have to have the second thing. And that is, you have to trace it to God. You have to see that the good emanates from God. If you want to recognize God from the good in this world, then you're going to have to trace it to God. So the idea is that, you know, if people only look at the last cause in front of them, then they'll attribute the good to the last cause. Like the example I think I've given here before, mention it again, a baby. Baby drinks a bottle of milk. So the baby understands that bottles give milk. So he is has a tremendous amount of gratitude to the bottle. Thanks the bottle every day for giving him milk. Gets a little bit older, and he sees that the mother pours the milk from a carton or a sack into the bottle. He says, Vey, I've been giving the thanks to the bottle. It's not bottles that give milk, it's containers that give milk. So he gives thanks to the container. Then he gets a little bit older, and he sees the mother takes the container out of the refrigerator. He says, oh, it's refrigerators that give milk. Then he gets a little bit older, goes into the country, and he sees the cows give milk. Thanks to the cows. Then he sees the cows eat grass. Thanks to grass. Eventually, if you trace everything back to its source, you come to the first cause. The first source is the Rabban Shalom. So everything you can trace back to God. So therefore, in order to really not sin and have a relationship with God, to know who feeds you and who's your master and where everything comes from, first you have to recognize good, not cover it up. You have to recognize it even in the small things. And you have to trace it back to its source. If you do all of that, then you won't sin. Because you realize that all the good that you have, and you'll recognize so much of it, comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. How could you be so ungrateful and rebel against the Ribbono Shel Olam, who does so much good for you? Keeps your heart beating, keeps you breathing, and so on. Yes?
I was just going to tell you, you said about burying the Chatayim. Yom Kippur, I said, no, we're burying the Chatayim, and where are we sprouting again as a result?
Okay, that's nice. And there they buried the bodies, who eventually would also respawn. Okay.
I have a curiosity. Since it's such a great Yom Tov, how can we only recognize it with not saying Tachlis?
Because since the Maaseh, there is no Beis HaMikdash, right? In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, of Bayis Sheni, they had other reasons. No, they had other reasons for making it a Yom Tov. Today, because of the Churban, right, and the only reason is, that's left is Harugei Beitar, so we can't get carried away because of the Zecher of the Churban, I think. Right? In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, there were other reasons. Didn't have yet the reason for Harugei Beitar to continue it after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and that was the idea. Okay. Another thing says that Be'eras HaTorah Hazos, Moshe Rabbeinu began to explain the Torah, and Rashi says Ba'ayin Lashonos, in 70 languages. Now the Jewish people didn't speak 70 languages. So why do you have to explain the Torah in 70 languages? What does that mean? So there's an idea, the Shaloh HaKodesh says it, others say it also. Originally, the whole world spoke Hebrew. Adam HaRishon originally spoke Hebrew. That was the mother tongue of the world, Lashon HaKodesh. And there weren't other languages. When did the other languages come about? By Migdal Bavel. When the Ribbono Shel Olam confused their languages and everybody. Now, it's true that languages develop also and are made up by people who live in the same place or whatever, and they begin to refer to different things for whatever reasons as different things, and that's how language evolves. That's also true. But both things are true. And that is that originally, how did the Ribbono Shel Olam start that there should be the beginnings of different languages? He distorted the Hebrew. In other words, everybody spoke Hebrew, and then the Ribbono Shel Olam mixed up their languages, gave them the roots of different languages, which they, over the years, developed. But there were words that originally were Hebrew words that were lost in those languages and are no longer used in Hebrew. I'll give an example. It says that, why are tefillin called totafos? Because tat in African is two, and pot in Katvian is two. Two and two is four. There's four batim in the tefillin. Therefore, those words, totafos, refers to tefillin. Now, why in the world did the Torah have to use an African and Katvian word to describe tefillin? Call them shnayim shnayim. If that's the idea, don't call them tat and pot. Those are in foreign languages. So I saw somebody says an idea. Says the tefillin shel rosh are supposed to put fear into the spirit of the goyim. The ro kolam be'oris ki shem Hashem nikra lecha. Right, the goyim will see that God's name is on you, and they'll have fear and respect for you. And the Gemara says elu tefillin shel rosh. When they see your tefillin, they're gonna. There's a famous story with the Vilna Gaon. I think they say the same story about the Balei Tanya. So I heard about the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon once had to stay in a certain inn where the innkeeper was a terrible rabid anti-Semite and used to molest the guests, the Jews who never had to stay in his hotel. So come in and beat them or whatever, and that was it. That was, you know, that was par for the course. There was no other place to stay. So he was in this inn, and he had his talis and tefillin, he was learning. He used to wear his talis and tefillin all day. And the innkeeper came in, with a real, you know, nasty look, and he looked like he was going to do something. I started yelling at them, you're destroying my thing, or whatever. And the Vilna Gaon turned around and looked at him, and the guy froze, mumbled a few words, apologized, and walked out, meekly. So his shaman said, you got to tell me what you said, you know, what magical Kabbalah words you said to, you know, to disarm this guy. He said, nothing magical. It says that when you see the tefillin, right, it puts fear into them. I turned around, he saw my tefillin, and he says, come on, there's a lot of Jews who were here that they were molested while they were davening, wearing their tefillin. Obviously, it doesn't work all the time. He says, no, you don't understand. It doesn't say, Elu tefillin sha'al harosh. These are the tefillin on your head. These are tefillin sheberosh. If your tefillin, right, permeate your head, right, then the tefillin have an effect. If they're just on your head, tefillin don't have an effect. Okay, in any case, so therefore, since the tefillin sha'arosh have this power of instilling fear in the nations of the world, therefore the Torah referred to the tefillin in the language of the nations of the world. It's supposed to have an effect on them. Okay, that's a nice shot. The Shalom HaKadosh says something else. He says the word tat and pat are Hebrew words, original Hebrew, old Hebrew. They were lost to the Hebrew language. They were lost into these languages. And there are many words like that. The more you look into it, what's it called, that words that are Hebrew words, even if the etymology in the dictionary doesn't say that, right? Mobile comes from the word yovel. Movil, right? To move from place to place is yovel. People are free to go back to their original place. That's what yovel means. I'm sure the word mobile. We said once, in Hanukkah time, the word hollow. I looked up in the dictionary. The etymology is not Hebrew. Aura. But I'm sure it is. Hollow. Chalau.
Aura.
Right?
Aura.
Aura. From Aura. Aura. Yeah, there's a million words like that.
Shades.
Million words. Right? So a million words. The, so, there are words that were originally Hebrew words that were lost into these 70 languages. And they went out of usage in Hebrew. So in order to explain the Torah well, Moshe Rabbeinu had to find all these words that were in the 70 languages to cast light on the Torah completely, because you really couldn't understand the full gravity of all of Lashon Kodesh if you didn't have the words that were out of usage but were lost in these other languages. And that's why, it doesn't mean he said the Torah over 70 times in 70 different languages. It means that he utilized all 70 languages to explain the Torah. In fact, Rashi says that the word sneer, the Torah says to sneer, right, that these people call it sneer because in German, Schnee is snow. Right? The name for what's it called for the Hermon is sneer. So what does that have to do with German? But that's the idea. The Torah word sneer was lost into German as Schnee, right? But it really came from the Lashon HaKodesh of sneer. And it means snow. And that's where the word came from. Okay, so that's what it means that Moshe Rabbeinu explained the Torah in utilizing all 70 languages. Okay, one last thing. I think that's end on a bright note over here. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu is describing the sin of the Meraglim. Okay, I'm going to read you the psukim, and you tell me what's wrong here. It says, "Vayita b'nei Adov, you came to me, you said, let's send people to spy out the land. And I thought it was a good idea, and I took 12 people from you, one from each tribe, and they went up the mountain, and they came to Nachal Eshkol, and they spied the land, and they took the fruit back, and they brought it, Vayashivu Osonu Davar, and they brought us back a report, Vayomer, what did they say? Tova Haaretz Asher Hashem Elokeinu Nosim La. They said, the land is very good. V'lo Avisim Lalos, and you didn't want to go up. And you rebelled against God. That's Moshe Rabbeinu's description of the Chet HaMeraglim. What is wrong with this picture?
They said, we can't do it.
Yeah, he left out like the main thing. They didn't come back and say, it's a great land. They said, it's a great land, but... And that was the sin. And that's why you didn't want to go up. So why did Moshe Rabbeinu leave out like... So Rashi says, who said it's a good land? Kol Levin Yoshua. Okay, but there was 10 others that said something else. Why did Moshe say that? He's telling over the sin. He left out like the main part. So I have two things, both are the same thing. Moshe Rabbeinu was so conditioned to only do good, conditioned himself. He didn't hear Lashon Hara. His ears didn't hear it. Right? He only heard, his ears were tuned only to good things. Something that was usher to hear, his ears didn't hear it. Right? It became, it says, that if a person conditions himself to use those parts of his body that he has control over, okay, only in a good way, then the Rabbanu Shalom does him a present. Even the parts of the body you don't have control over, the Rabbanu Shalom makes it that you only comes good. So when the spies came back, what did Moshe Rabbeinu hear? Only the first part. It's good land. He didn't even hear the other part. She said, you could have been like me. You're not allowed to listen to Lashon Hara. You're not allowed. So maybe by you it didn't happen automatically. But you should have blocked it out. Lashon Hara you don't hear, you don't believe. So all only I heard was they said the land's a good land. Everybody said that. And you, what's it called, heard the other part. That's part of the problem. The way Rashi says, I heard what Yoshua and Kalev said. Because they said the right thing. You listened to the other ten. Right? You shouldn't have listened to them. They said Lashon Hara. You should have listened only to these two. I only heard what those two said. You listened to the other ten. That was your problem. But if you had been like me, all I heard was the good report. So what was the problem? You heard a bad report. That's part of this. That's part of the sin. That's part of the problem. Or the whole first part of the day.
It'll probably be easier to get into the party than to get into the kids.
When do we get back together?
Probably the week into Elul. A week into Elul. Because I'm going to be away for the first few days of Elul in Chicago.